What I should do is pull up the volume on the phone here, because I have my friend, I think. Pretty sure, yeah. My friend, Vineyard Saker. He's a co-blogger of mine over at thestressblog.com. He has his own blog. It's vineyardsaker.blogspot.com. And so, we got some things to go over here. Welcome back to the show, VS.
Hey, thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to have you on here. I got a few things to talk with you about. When Gareth Porter was on the show last week, we talked about how the Israeli government was really pushing for a war against Iran immediately after September 11th, and how basically Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, the neocon cabal wanted Iraq first, and how the Israelis basically got on board and helped push us into the war in Iraq. But what they really wanted all along was war against Iran. And you made the comment on the blog there that, hey, no way, don't let the Israelis out of this, that, you know, they were very responsible for the American war in Iraq and so forth. And I was just wondering whether you saw the cover article, the spotlight today on antiwar.com. It's a Huffington Post entry by David Bromwich. Did you see that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's called Iraq, Israel, Iran. And it's a review of the new book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, authors.
Yeah, I'm reading it right now.
The famous. Oh, are you? I haven't gotten the book yet, but authors of the famous article by that name, very controversial article by that name. And anyway, according to David Bromwich, this is basically the story that that Mearsheimer and Walt tell as well. The Sharon government said, "Hey, Iran." Hit Iran, and that when it became clear that the Bush crew wanted to go to Iraq first, that it was then that the Israeli government got in line and caught up with the neocons and began helping to lie us into war in Iraq. Is that what you're getting from the book there?
Well, to tell you the truth, I have no way of knowing. I haven't, still haven't decided, you know, whether Jerusalem runs the U.S. or Washington runs Jerusalem and Israel, and where the real center of decision-making is. I mean, it's pretty clear to me that these guys are working together. But, you know, the comparative influence of American neocons versus Israeli Likudniks is just really hard to establish. I mean, it's plausible.
Yeah.
Sure it is. What's not plausible is saying, like others do, you know, that Israelis were opposed and were warning the U.S. about Saddam Hussein. Clearly, after September 11th, they had a perfect reason to use the, you know, flag-waving anger in this country to try to get, you know, something gone. They started with Afghanistan, which was the obvious one, at least from their point of view, and went for the next one, having somebody in power like Saddam Hussein. And clearly he was not that hard to attack. And keep in mind, attacking him also got the oil lobby on board and everybody else.
Right.
Iran, who really wants it? I mean, I know you mentioned Lockheed a couple of times. You know, maybe, maybe not, but even if Lockheed is behind that, that's still a pretty small player compared to, you know, the lobby for it. So I guess they took what they could.
Well, do you think that the military-industrial complex is a small player compared to the lobby? I guess Andrew Coburn, when I interviewed him, he said, well, this is how he defines the neoconservatives. They are the combination of the military-industrial complex lobbyists and the Israel lobby. They're the amalgam. They figured that the neocons, when they moved from the left to the right, they needed some new allies. So they teamed up with the Christian right crazies and with Lockheed in them.
Yeah, and one of your guests mentioned the oil, oil, Israel, and logistics approach.
Right.
It's not, Mearsheimer and Walter are doing a good thing explaining that the lobby is not a monolithic organization. It's not, doesn't have, you know, a central commander and secret handshakes. But the military-industrial complex is partially enmeshed with the lobby and everything else. So I don't think it speaks as clearly, it's not as monothematic as the lobby is. So they will be working together, as they had in 91, by the way, for the first war against Saddam Hussein over Kuwait. But I don't think that this is the military-industrial complex is something that can be, you know, opposed to the lobby. I would say that what I call in my blog, you know, the old Anglo Guard, which is more the oil people, are way more powerful. And they have been opposing the lobby with extreme energy. I mean, the Walt Mearsheimer is just an example. You have Jimmy Carter, you have Michael Scheuer, you have many other people who are, you know, very much of the old Anglo slash CIA slash oil elite, who now are leaking like crazy, writing books against it, for the first time raising the issue of the lobby. I would identify the major opponent of the lobby in the U.S. less as a military industrial complex and more as what I call the old Anglo guard.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I talked to Wayne White last week, and he was on the Baker Commission, the Baker Study Group. And I asked him about all this fighting going on between, and it's been going on, too, the battle over the surge between Edward, I'm going to say it's wrong, Djerian, and Frederick Kagan and the guys over at AEI. And I have to tell you, here's where it all comes down to. This is the way Greg Palast has it in his book, too. He's got this chart that has, here's the neocon side, and here's the James Baker side, and here they are fighting against each other, and here are their different plans and their different alliances with different Iraqis and all this different stuff. But at the top of the chain of both commands is Dick Cheney. I mean, James Baker is Dick Cheney's lawyer. Baker Botts represents Halliburton. And
true.
Yet, on the other hand, it's Cheney who's been the one to go along with all these neocons all along.
But again, you're thinking in terms of chain of command. I don't think there is such a supreme commander of anything, either in the lobby or in the Anglo group, for that matter. I mean, people also have their own careers, their own opportunities, their own struggles for power. Cheney and Rumsfeld hated each other, but they still worked together. You know, I mean, it's not like they're simple. And I would like to stress here something. You know, I sound kind of racist when I pit Anglos versus Jews, to put it directly here. But I used to work in a past distant life for a think tank, a very conservative think tank inside the Beltway. And being myself from Europe, you know, after a while working there, the director of that think tank actually told me with hushed tones, once he had figured out that, you know, I was not an American, you know, those Jews, they're actually, you know, taking over. And he gave me many examples of in conservative institute. He mentioned specifically the Heritage Foundation that initially had much more of a Anglo-Christian slant who turned rapidly pro-IPAC, etc. I heard that from several people in the Anglo group who certainly identify Jews by their nationality. So it's not an endorsing that kind of separation. I think it's nonsense to say that all Anglos or all Jews in the U.S. think the same thing. But I think those two groups identify each other in exactly those terms, that they know that there's the Anglos on one side, the old guard, and the new guard is Jewish.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's an important point to say, and as you mentioned, this doesn't mean all Jews or all Anglos anything. We're talking about two different factions in D.C. and New York fighting over power, and, one of them
and
is what they
always call
factions,
them. Both factions, I believe, identify the, quote, opponent or temporary ally in ethnic terms. I mean, that's what I saw when I was working in Washington. That was in the late 80s. I saw it with my eyes, and me being neither Jewish or Anglo, it was kind of amusing for me to see how in the supposedly melting pot of the USA, people identified each other very much in ethnic terms.
Yeah, well, and there is some of that. In fact, I'm kind of ignorant on this history. I really, I wish Angela Keaton was here. I know she could explain it a lot better, but she just told me the story one time about, because she knows all the history of the libertarian movement going all the way back and everything, was raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so she knows this whole history of all the different magazines, right? All the different fighting in the magazines, the National Review this and Commentary that, and all that going back decades and decades. And for her, that's how she kind of explained it. Really was the old establishment was the Anglo-American establishment, you know, like Carol Quigley called it, what we used to call the Eastern liberal establishment or whatever here. And the libertarian and neoconservative movements were basically made up of Catholics and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not particularly a Jewish thing as much as it is, there's a lot of Catholics involved in the neoconservative movement. And of course, the libertarian movement has been led by Catholics and Jews all along too. And you know, for a time in the 70s, there were a lot of alliances here against the socialist left between the libertarians and the neocons and so forth. And so I think you're right that this does have a lot of, we used to be the second tier, but now we're moving up, and how do you like that kind of attitude?
Yep.
And personally, I kind of like that. I remember when I was a kid hearing about a country club in Houston where no Jews were allowed, so the Jews bought it. So how do you like that? And I think that's hilarious, you know? That's how
people I'm sure you remember the comments about the crazy downstairs, which was the White House way among Anglos of speaking of the Jews around, you know, Wolfowitz and the rest of the crowd. I mean, they really dislike each other.
Right.
I think these guys have very deep racist feelings, actually.
Well, and you look,
but when needed, you know, they will switch sides or, you know, work for either side as Cheney did, and they will work together towards a common goal. So when it's clear, like the 91 war, or still pretty clear, like the second war against Saddam Hussein, you know, they work together in perfect concert, and not a single Mersheimer, Walt, Carter, Scheuer, anybody else said a single word about any kind of lobby in the U.S. Now suddenly that only one lobby is really interested in a war with Iran, suddenly the Anglos, they also got purged from the CIA and a lot of other places like the Pentagon, now they're fighting back because they're losing power and they're really mad.
Yeah. And you know, to be even more clear about this, because I hate the even the idea that, you know, either of us would be accused of anti-Semitism here. Or
well, we will anyway, so.
You know, whatever. People can say what they want, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, all the best anti-neocons, well, first of all, who's been convicted of spying for Israel? Larry Franklin, a Catholic. You know, and some of the most despicable of the neocons have been Catholics, not Jews. You know, it's an ideology we're talking about.
Yeah, sure.
And of course, on the other side of that, who are the best reporters in America covering this story? Seymour Hersh and Jim Loeb and Robert Dreyfus and
Amy Goodman and Greg Pallas, of course.
Yeah, sure. Eric Garris runs antiwar.com. So
no doubt.
So please don't anybody get us all wrong here, what we're talking about. But see, this is the thing. This is the I want to be a fly on the wall when Dick Cheney and David Rockefeller have lunch, but I can't be. And so, but I like to wonder about these things, and I like to try to measure as best I can from the outside looking in, you know, who's who in the establishment and what they're about. And, you know, I think Wayne White was very honest last week in saying, listen, It's not even just the Israel lobby. It's, you could say it's the Israel lobby, but that goes back 50 years to the point where now Americans in super majorities overwhelmingly support Israel and are willing to go along with Israeli policy. And the polls show it too. Are you in favor of war with Iran? No. Are you in favor of war with Iran if George Bush says it's necessary? Well, yeah, the numbers go up. Are you in favor of war with Iran if they're a threat to Israel? Oh, absolutely. And the numbers go up even further. So
as Finkelstein, Norman Finkelstein, said on the Doha debate, you can find that on YouTube online or Google video, you would then have to ask the question why it is that the Americans think that. And if you look where they get their information and the rapidly neocon corporate press in this country, I mean, that's not surprising. It's like saying, you know, that Germans like to goose step down the street. Sure, they do that because the propaganda pushes them towards that. But it's precisely by stifling open debate, by not allowing anybody to raise these issues, that they achieve that.
Right. And to get back to the facts of the case, there's no other group of people in this country pushing. Now, there are a lot of people, I guess, who are willing to be, you know, pushed and pulled along. There's no other real group pushing for war with Iran other than the Israel lobby. And it's a war with Iran that, as we've covered on this show over and over and over again, that will be an absolute and total disaster for the United States, presumably for Israel, too. I can't see how a war with Iran could possibly benefit Israel at this point or any other. But this is, and never mind that, this is absolutely against the interests of the United States of America. And to have a foreign country's lobby pushing our country into another war in the Middle East is absolutely, you know, give me a good word. It's not okay. It must be stopped.
Well, and you're quite right in pointing out something which is really overlooked, is that the lobby has really hurt Israel. And if they continue having that kind of power in the country, and if, God forbid, a war with Iran starts, it's going to hurt Israel really bad. Because I don't believe that the U.S. can actually come out, achieve an outcome which would be desirable to the U.S. at all. I think it would be at major risk for very serious consequences. And if the United States really gets hurt there, then there will be a huge raising of the issue of the lobby. And, you know, Israel will be blamed as a country. The region will have a very influential, victorious Shia regime both in Iran and in Iraq. If I were Israeli, I would oppose the lobby with everything I have. And a lot of Israelis actually do oppose it. They have the same problem as Americans in this country. They have a difficulty to put their message out. They're called self-hating Jews, et cetera. But it's happening. Increasingly, it is happening.
Well, and the thing is, I think a reasonable person on a sunny afternoon, if you asked him, would agree that the best policy probably for Israel would be to try to shake hands and work out agreements with their neighboring countries and populations and you know, try to make friends. Tell them, look, we're not going away, but we don't have to always be at each other's throats. Let's work this out. That's the clear policy if you want Israel to exist and be safe in the long term. Otherwise, you'd have to adopt this insane idea, which I don't think any reasonable person on a sunny afternoon would think is the proper policy, which is smash them all and dominate them militarily forever.
Well, keep in mind that the Israelis are even more frightened than Americans, though. They're frightened by suicide bombers. They're frightened by Qassam rockets. They're frightened by what they perceive as hard-to-stop, if not invincible, Hezbollah fighters. And they're absolutely terrified of a nuclear Iran. And most of them do not know that Iran has no nuclear weapon program. They do sincerely believe that, you know, Ahmadinejad can press the button and it's going to happen. And even furthermore, most of them have never been exposed to the idea that a nuclear-armed Iran would not be a danger to Israel. Some people raise the issue gradually. I read the Israeli press fairly often, and it's starting to come out, but mostly you have a terrified public. And they have a sense, you know, it's everybody against us. We're in a region where we're not loved. And that's true. No doubt here. And, you know, what's the solution? And the thought of giving up, well, they already have given up, you know, the myth of the invincible Israeli army. They got really kicked by 1,000 Hezbollah fighter tops against, you know, several Israeli divisions. So the last thing they can latch onto is a nuclear-armed Israel and everybody else not having nuclear weapons. And a terrified public will want to maintain that.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think you make a good point that even if Iran did have nukes, what are they going to do? Get themselves nuked? I mean, Israel could wipe Persia off the face of the map in an instant.
Well, not an instant and not all of it, but it could hurt them definitely.
I mean, they got 400-something hydrogen bombs, last I heard.
Yeah, but you need to deliver them. I mean, Iran is a big country. They couldn't just, you know, wipe them all off the map, but they could really, really impose huge damage on it. There's no doubt about that. And besides, I really don't think the Iranians have any intention of either acquiring or actually much less so ever using it. What they would like, definitely, if they had a nuclear weapon, is to prevent a U.S. attack. So somewhere, if the party that pushes Iran towards a nuclear weapon program more than anybody else are the neocons. If the Iranians had the same comfort as the, you know, North Koreans had, they would not be facing an attack by the U.S. So that's a powerful argument in favor of having a nuclear weapon.
Well, and that goes to the larger point of how counterproductive all of neoconservative policy seems to be. I think the first time I ever spoke with Chalmers Johnson, he talked about how during the Cold War, and when policymakers had a bit more sane approach, their biggest fear was a Paris-Berlin-Moscow axis and or Beijing as well. And he said, that's exactly what we're creating now.
Yes.
We're now, by claiming benevolent global hegemony, no one will ever oppose us, no peer will ever rise up to anywhere near our status ever again, and we're going to rule every country and every continent and every economy, and nobody's going to stand in our way. All that's doing is pushing the only people who actually can be competitors to the United States into each other's arms.
Well, not only that, but there's another axis which is gradually developing and largely unnoticed, is Iran and Pakistan, which are getting closer and closer and closer. They're even discussing security ties. Now, mostly of that is border security. But still, those two countries have been cozying up to each other very much. And Pakistan, I would think, is the real threat for the entire region. I mean, I think it's one of the most dangerous countries out there because it's filled with al-Qaeda types, or Taliban types would be probably more accurate, and it has nuclear weapons already, including delivery systems.
Right.
So I would worry about Pakistan long before I would worry about Iran.
Well, tell me about Russia's relationship with Iran. I have to tell you, if I was like some sneaky KGB guy in a shadow somewhere, I would probably be trying to encourage the Iranians to behave in ways which will overextend America more and more. And I probably would even be willing to sacrifice Iran and push them into full-scale conflict if I thought that over the long term what it would do is bring America to its knees. And I wonder, you know, whether you have any speculation at all behind or about Russia's relationship, or, well, obviously facts first and speculation second, about Russia's relationship with Iran.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to spend a lot of time actually dealing with Russia and its security establishment. The relationship is very interesting. First of all, I have to realize that Russia is a monolith. There are several groups, shall I say, schools of thought inside the country. By and large, right now, Russia is what I call a thugocracy, which is basically a mix of mafia and ex-KGB people, or mafia inside the new KGB, etc. They are led pretty strongly by Putin, who controls that fairly well. But some agencies have a lot of leeway. For instance, Russian intelligence services, and particularly the military, I know for a fact, has sympathies with Iran. So on one hand, you would find people, the economic people, for instance, who are building the plant at Buxar in Iran, who are at times having tensions with Iranians over payments. But at the same time, I know for a fact that the Russian military intelligence has a huge interest and admiration for Iran. First of all, because they consider them as very interesting partners. There have been quiet exchanges between both security establishments. The Russians came back very impressed. I spoke to several of them who said, you know, you wouldn't believe the analytical centers these guys have and their how you know, educated their analysts are. They came very, very impressed by their Iranian counterparts. They also like them because they're anti-American, they're patriotic, and they're religious, which has more and more appeal in Russia today. So they feel common interest. They certainly know it's a good market for weapons. And I think they would support Iran, and that's why I think that everything that the military intelligence, or the civilian intelligence service, the external one in Russia, can get about U.S. preparations, I'm fairly sure is passed directly onto the Iranian leadership, as was the case, by the way, with Saddam Hussein before the war in 91. I think the Russians would probably not, as a country, push the United States towards war with Iran. I don't think that would be Putin's policy. It's just too dangerous to do that. But do I think that there are people inside the Russian security establishment who will, on one hand, push the Americans, on the other hand, prepare the Iranians, help them with everything they can, and hope that the Americans, you know, really get overextended and bogged down? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's been the history of the past, I guess, 30, 40 years that the Americans and the Russians take turns trying to give each other another Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Very much so. But I would not want to make it sound like Iran would be a junior partner in that. I mean, the Iranians are completely independent, but they've been very careful. For instance, look at Chechnya. The Iranians have never supported the Chechen separatists, unlike other Muslim countries. They did send fighters, and they did support the Bosnian Muslims in Kosovo, but that they considered fair. So they're not allied to Russia, but they are not going to ever antagonize Russia too openly. And they have not done so. If you look at the way they refer to the Chechens, they never refer to as resistance, but they say that, the, you know, the guerrillas or the insurgency. So there is a quiet and very close relationship between the security establishments of both countries.
And now, what do you think about all these assassinations and so forth? The journalist and the former intelligence guy who've been whacked, I guess Putin got the blame pretty much for all those things. Do you agree with that?
No. And I dislike Putin intensively. I very much dislike what he represents, which is a return to the Soviet, you know, bad old days, as far as I'm concerned. But in the case of Politkovskaya, the journalist, actually people were arrested for her murder very recently. I think it was last week. Concerning the former intelligence agent, he was involved in all sorts of shady dealings, and I just don't see the successor to the KGB, which today is called the SVR, botching in such a ridiculous way, you know, an assassination. Russia today has at least two units fully dedicated to external assassinations. None of them would botch the way they did. And I frankly think that a lot of that can be explained more by mafia links and Chechen mafia links specifically. And it's used then by the British, for instance, and other Western countries to, you know, give Russia a hard time politically. So I want to insist, I very much think Putin is capable of killing people, and, you know, they are, as I said, thugs and former KGB people, but I think most of those assassinations are not the hands of the Russian intelligence services.
And what do you make of the recent renewal of Russian bomber flights?
Nothing much, really. I mean, it's part of courtesy of the neocons. The price of oil has been high. Russia has more money, and Putin is clearly trying to reestablish a military, not a former military power of the Soviet Union, but at least to reestablish some how shall I call it, mid-level solid military power for Russia, and that includes many things. It includes much more many more exercises, joint exercises abroad. It includes strengthening airborne brigade, special operations brigade, and includes strengthening the air force, procuring new equipment, etc. And part of that is simply reestablishing patrols. But nobody in Russia is seriously planning for a nuclear war with bombers against the West. So it's just more a show of the flag and a reestablishment of capabilities than any kind of threat or message.
More about pleasing the domestic audience in Russia, you think?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Besides, the real threat for the U.S., if it were, or, you know, the West, doesn't come from Russian bombers. The real threat would be from mobile land-based missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been also growing, by the way. So Putin has been expanding over the past years, gradually, I would say, and slowly. It's nothing like it was in the Soviet times, but has been expanding military expenditures and training.
Now, how do you think Russia would respond in the event of Dick Cheney unleashing the Air Force against Iran? I know, well, I guess maybe this is dated information, but at least there used to be a bunch of Russian scientists at the Bushehr reactor. In danger of bombing some Russians in Iran, and what do you think that Putin would do?
Well, precious nothing. They're going to bitch and yell in the Security Council and, you know, express outrage and stuff like this. But keep in mind, they're realists. They know they can't start a war over that. They have absolutely no desire to start a war over this. Look how they betrayed Serbia for all their grand promises of helping, you know, the Orthodox Slavic Serbs. They completely betrayed them. They're bribable. Remember, it's mafia people. Many years ago in the 80s, I once interviewed a fairly high-ranking defector from the then Soviet Union, and he one of the things he commented to me was, you know, the Americans are wrong to send diplomats to speak with the Soviet diplomats. They should send the Chicago chief of police. And I took this comment to mean, you know, that's somebody tougher and the diplomats are too liberal. Whereas what he really meant, and understood only later, is that culturally, a U.S. sheriff would understand, somebody who deals with the local mob, would understand the mentality of the Russians much better.
Mm.
They're way closer to Pablo Escobar or, you know, some Cali cartel or the, you know, Don Corleone in the Godfather, and they are of some communist, nationalist, religious, orthodox. They're none of that. They're essentially mafia kind of people with the same kind of mythology around them, and they will just, you know, when they see that it's too late for Iran and the war has started, they will help very quietly. Individual agencies or group of people will help the Iranians with what they can. They will politically exploit it to the maximum. They'll hope for the worst for the U.S., but they will not get involved directly. Absolutely not. There's no risk of Third World War over the Middle East. I don't buy that for one sec.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, I guess that's what I would have assumed, too, that, you know, Iran is Iran, but it's not worth a world war over.
You know, I don't think they would do it even if the U.S. landed in southern Russia, or in southern Russia maybe. But, you know, even look at the expansion of NATO. They did nothing. They huffed and puffed and protested it. But
right.
They did nothing, not against Estonia, Latvia, nobody. They're not going to get into it. They don't want a foreign military adventure.
Now, let's redirect back here to the Middle East, and specifically the redirection back toward America's traditional allies, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the Sunni so-called
mm-hmm.
moderates, the dictatorships that are loyal to the United States. I think you posted up in some comments on the blog during the show last week that this is far too little too late. There's basically no Sunni resistance worthwhile left to ally with.
Oh, yeah, sure. Because keep in mind that Iraq is not a centralized country. The big place, Baghdad, is completely Shia-controlled. Dar Jamal, I think, the other week was wrote a piece where he was interviewed. I'm not sure when he said that, you know, most people in Iran are Shia, most refugees are Sunni. I mean, that tells the story. And sure, there is a Sunni insurgency, and it's possible to try to ally the U.S. with them. I don't think it's going to tip the balance for one second. It's just absolutely way too late. That had to be done when Saddam Hussein was in power, propped up by a lot of money. You know, the Mukhabarat, the secret service who could torture, kill, and, you know, disappear entire villages. Then it was still doable to repress them. Now it's too late. I mean, the Shias are out of the box, and nobody's going to put them back in. And I don't even think that the Sunnis would ever agree to make good allies for the U.S. because they have the U.S. to blame for everything bad that happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to butcher Americans at the first opportunity. Now, if they can get weapons from them, if they can, you know, strengthen their fiefdoms for a while, they'll do it. But still, this is not something, you know, that's not at all a strategy for protecting American troops. Keep also in mind that there are no battle lines, you know, or clearly cut zones in that in Iran today. So if, for instance, take the American accusation that the Al-Quds force entered Basra disguised as American private contractor with SUVs, etc., and then kidnapped a bunch of soldiers and killed them, well, if they say that's true, I don't believe it is, but if it say it is true, how hard would it be for the Shia to strike Americans anywhere in the Anbar province, in Kurdistan? They could do it with no problem.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about the kidnapping and executions in Karbala, right?
Karbala, yes.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a viable strategy. I think, again, it's too little, too late, and I think the neocons are extremely reactive. They don't have a long-term plan. They kid themselves, they're delusional, and now that's just another typical, you know, hope for them. Let's see if that works. That's because they don't understand the country and the region at all.
Well, you know, the headlines yesterday was Bush caught. He tried to deny it, but oops, it's here's the proof that he was informed of Paul Bremer's decision to completely and totally disband not just the Iraqi army, but the entire Baathist government down to the local janitors at the elementary schools and everybody else. And I guess he thought he was going to get away with saying that the buck stopped lower on the chain. But no, there's the letter to the president all about it and his response back and so forth. And one of the comments, the president, or the, I guess it was his press secretary or somebody, had said that he couldn't remember why it was that they fired the Iraqi army, why it was that they got rid of the Baathist government. And I just thought, you know, maybe because I know the president listens to the show every day, maybe I could remind him that it was because the Shia said so. And because if he did not do what Ayatollah Sistani said and abolish the Baathist government down to every last detail, then Sistani was basically promising a widespread Shia resistance against the occupation. They were going to have to start the war all over again. And so
In all fairness to Dabia, and I usually don't defend him, what option did he have? I mean, the Americans had nothing like we would have needed to oppose Sistani and the majority. That's why they had to accept direct elections.
Yeah,
they
exactly.
only had the will to fight the little guy on the block, which was the, you know, the Sunni, and the Baathist Sunni even is more limited. And they thought they could get away with that, and it's a knee-jerk reaction.
Yep. And in fact, Glenn Greenwald had this great piece about the dishonesty of the neocons, as they are now saying, oh, well, you know, obviously the big purple-fingered election was a terrible mistake, and we just helped the Iranians win and so forth. You know, in the summer of 2007, they're saying that the very same people who said that all the rest of us had to shut up because of how wonderful the purple-fingered election was back in 2005.
Yeah, and the same thing, the wonderful election of Hamas, which was democratic and everything, the State Department wanted for the new Middle East. And it didn't work either. Or the revolution, the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon, which was also so wonderful. And they're about to have a presidential election, which is going to be just as wonderful. Of course, they just constantly screw up this by doing the same thing, by being completely inept, poorly informed. They don't know what they're doing, really.
So I guess what they're thinking now, I mean, close as I can tell, they figured that since they've given Iraq to Iran, or at least to the Shia majority, that the people with the political power and so forth, the Supreme Islamic Council and so forth, are so close to Iran that basically they just need to have a regime change in Iran. And then it'll be okay that Iran is so close with the guys in Iraq.
Sure. And they also blamed Iran for Lebanon last year, and they even blamed Iran for Hamas being in Gaza. Of course. And if that doesn't work, what do they have to lose? I mean, always keep that in mind. I know how insane that kind of thinking sounds to a normal person, but Olmert and Bush have absolutely nothing to lose.
They have completely painted themselves into a corner, really.
Yeah. Yeah, what can they do? You know, withdraw in an orderly way and say, oops, that's not going to fly.
Wow. So, let's see, I guess it was about... It was really 2005, I guess, was when Khalilzad was pushing to rehire the Ba'athists and kind of redirect toward the Sunni Arabs. Could it have even worked then?
I don't know. I really don't know. It's hard to do.
I mean, because even then, in 2005, those of us who were looking at prospects for war with Iran were saying, yeah, do what Khalilzad says. At least if you're going to occupy this place forever, you know, at least get on, you know, in the Sunni provinces and so forth and try to find some new supply lines that don't run through Shia territory, because otherwise, it's the same dead horse I beat up here every day. If America bombs Iran while our guys are surrounded by Shia Arabs in the south of Iraq, they're dead meat.
Well, there's no really other supply lines to talk about. So that's out. By road and by sea, you have to go through Shia territory. Syria is not going to be exactly that deal, you know, rear base for pre-positioning equipment. They made many mistakes. When they got in, Baghdad was still a mixed city. Now it's a fairly ethnically cleansed one. That's not possible to reverse. They allowed the Badr Brigade to come in, which was an organized, well-trained force, and, you know, become the police and the government. That was a huge mistake. They single-handedly made Muqtada al-Sadr famous by shutting down his newspaper, trying to arrest him, pinning a stupid charge of assassination on him, and then fighting two battles against him. I mean, every single step that they made strengthened the Shia. And I would say in 2005, you said, if that's what you're referring to, I think it would be already too late. By then, I would say you cannot get the Shia right back. If they had come in and immediately aligned themselves with some kind of strongman, Saddam Hussein, maybe that would have been an option. But even that, I doubt. But now the Shia own the country and the Iranians are right behind them.
And, now,
and the Saudis have nothing to offer besides money and Al-Qaeda, which is really a small force in there.
It appears to me that the trial balloon's about trying to overthrow Maliki and replace him with Iyad Alawi has kind of already run its course. What do you think?
Oh, that's nonsense. They're the same thing as Karzai in Afghanistan. They're just, you know, the mayor of the Green Zone. At least Karzai is considered the mayor of Kabul. They're just the mayors of the Green Zone. It's completely irrelevant. I mean, it's more of a psychotherapy exercise than anything else.
Well, so
it has no impact on the crucial regions. The Brits just handed over the south to the Shia. Anbar, there's a very good piece by Juan Cole called How Al-Anbar Isn't What's Safe and How It is calm, is artificially produced. I have it on my blog, and it's on his blog, too. Even Anbar is not in good shape, and nothing they will do with anybody in the Green Zone will make any difference.
Yeah, you know, Bush's big surprise PR visit there was way out in a base in the absolute middle of nowhere out in the desert.
It actually was hilarious that he went there and you know, posted nice photographs with the troops, and it's pathetic.
Yep. And, you know, of course, that's the next talking point, too, right, is that, well, if we leave, Al-Qaeda will take over Al-Anbar province. How much truth is there to that, do you think?
Zero. They're too small. They're way too small to take control of anything over in Iraq. That's nonsense.
Well, but the president says that they're going to establish a base there and then create an Osama bin Laden caliphate from Spain to Indonesia. Who could stop them if not us?
Well, us is the only people that can only help them towards that goal and not stop them. Who could stop them? I would tell you, Iran and the Shia are the single strongest force against Al-Qaeda today. And that's true in Lebanon, and that's true in Iraq. They are strong, organized. They have by far the best intelligence service and military in the Middle East. They are the natural ally in a war against Al-Qaeda, but that's just not acceptable to the neocons.
Well, and they've said that openly, haven't they, the Al-Qaeda types, that we want to try to foment war between the United States and Iran.
Yep, of course. That makes sense, because that's their biggest threat. There's no Al-Qaeda in Basra or Karbala, and for good reason. And nothing much of Al-Qaeda in Iran either. I mean, well, not that they haven't been trying, but they are mortal enemies. And that would be a powerful ally, but there's no alliance happening with Iran as long as the neocons are in power in the U.S.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, we wouldn't have to be best friends forever, you know. We could just, you know, cease with all the hostile intention all the time, all the saber rattling. And again,
well, I would notice that Iran did not do much saber rattling against the U.S.
Oh, no,
so
no,
it's a
I'm
one-way
talking about the Americans.
Yeah. Oh, I agreed.
Yeah.
I agree, and get some kind of, and Iran offered a deal even on Israel. I mean, they're also realists. They know exactly well that they're not going to throw the U.S. out of the Middle East or, you know, wipe Israel off the map. They never had that intention anyways. But their main concern have always been the Wahhabi Salafi types in Afghanistan through the Taliban's, Al-Qaeda, and the Ba'athists. Now the Ba'athists are gone, and the last thing they want is a Sunni Wahhabi kind of force in Iraq, and that's what they're going to fight.
Well, it's been reported that they have Al-Qaeda guys in prison there in Iran, including even Osama bin Laden's son.
Yeah, I heard that. I wonder what the charges for holding him is. I mean, just because his dad is Osama, or is there something else behind it? But yeah, I've heard that too.
I think probably they're just holding him. I don't know whether they, you know, have any actual law they're applying to him or not. They're probably just holding him because they don't want to be the country that ever let him go.
Well, and they have a long, long-standing hatred for the Wahhabis. I mean, they always consider the Taliban, and the Chechens, I would add, as being really non-Muslims, as a bunch of barbarians. If you look at the role, for instance, Saudi Arabia or the Taliban or even the Chechen leaders want for women, and, you know, most of the parliament, I think, in Iran is now composed of women. They're in politics. They're in all positions. They're on TV. They have a completely different view of Islam, and they're mutually exclusive. So they really hate the Wahhabis. And it's a long story of hatred between the Wahhabis and the Iranian Shia.
Yeah, but Eli Lake at the New York Sun would say that you're just being naive, that they're all Muslims and they might be different from each other, but they have more in common with each other than they do with us, and that they surely would work together against us if they thought they wanted to or needed to.
Yeah, they might. I would agree with that. But considering the case of the Wahhabi, I think it's the worst threat. And I think Iran would gladly cooperate with the U.S. against them. That doesn't mean that Shia and Sunnis would always oppose each other. Not at all.
Yeah,
I mean, there even has been a ruler by the Cairo. Hello?
Yeah, I'm just saying, what you're saying is we just need to stop creating the circumstances where they might let bygones be bygones.
Yes, and just use objective, community of interest when it's available. I'm not saying, you know, becoming Iran over here. Or making them, you know, NATO members or close allies. I'm just saying sometimes countries that we have a bone with have common interests with us that we can exploit.
Yep. And, of course, anybody can go and do a Google search and find the Iranian peace offer of 2003 where they put everything on the table from their support for Hezbollah and Hamas to the nuclear program and relations with Israel and everything else.
Yeah, or take the example of what happened in Lebanon where the Christian general Aoun became a close ally to Hezbollah. And he's a Christian, and he was not at all pro-Muslim at all, and he was a big opponent of Syria. And now these guys are in a common political bloc.
Yeah, well, there you have it. All right, we're all out of time. Thanks very much for your insight today. Everybody, Vineyard Saker, you can read what he writes at vineyardsaker.blogspot.com or check him out over at thestressblog.com, too. Thanks a lot, man.
Sure, bye-bye, and have a great day.